Right.
And now we're good to go.
We're on.
Gone.
All right. Very good. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Andy Nowicki, and tonight I'm very happy to be joined by author, blogger, and podcaster, Jason Horsley. Jason, you came to my attention first when you appeared on Sean Atwood's YouTube channel. And sort of, and I mean this in the best possible way, you among the guests that Sean Atwood has had on his channel, you kind of stood out like a sore thumb. I enjoy Sean Atwood's channel. I think he does good work, but some of it, I would dare say, sometimes verges towards the sensationalist. Mm-hmm. And you seemed you struck me as being somebody who was maybe a bit more intellectual, a bit more thoughtful, more. I'm not meaning to say this in a snobbish way or anything, but you struck me as more literary, and the more literary in your sensibility somehow. And what interested me about that was you were discussing the book that was then your current book, The Vice of Kings, which is in its own way, I suppose, we could categorize it as a book about the phenomenon that's sometimes called pedogate, the issue of high level complicity in child trafficking, child sexual abuse, seemingly on a scale that could boggle the mind. And this is an issue that's been kind of near and dear to my heart for several years now. It's been something that I've been really really looking into, sometimes looking into a little too much, a little too closely. It's one of those things where you stare into the abyss and the abyss stares back. There's so much that's just abysmal about what's really going on out there. And it took me a while. I think I'm just to speak autobiographically about myself for a minute. It was several years ago when I first started looking into these kinds of things. And it was a story, I don't know if you've heard of it, in the UK, your station, you're living in Canada now, but you're from the UK. But there was a story that broke in the mid to late 80s that came to be known as the Franklin scandal.
Yeah.
And when I started looking into the Franklin scandal, it really, I'm not exaggerating when I say it caused me a degree of PTSD, even though it had absolutely nothing to do with me personally. I was still so struck by it. It knocked me down for the count. And I found myself in this kind of psychic position, psychic mindset, where I was just trying to tell myself, this isn't true, this isn't true, this can't be true. And I wanted desperately for it not to be true, but I couldn't convince myself that, there was just way too much evidence that it was true, that these powerful people were doing these terrible things to children, victimizing the innocent and getting away with it, and it was getting covered up by the same authorities who were supposed to be, in the world that I thought I lived in, the same kind of authorities that are supposed to be prosecuting the kind of criminals who do these, who commit these kinds of heinous acts. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of my my initiation into this thing, this you know, this ongoing scandal. I don't know what name it should go under, but I've for now gone with Pedogate. I guess that still has a kind of sensationalist edge to it in some way, but mm-hmm. But you know, you have to find some way to categorize it. And so that was, you know, I know that, and Sean Atwood covers a lot of this stuff on his channel. He's been very good at, you know, at covering the Jeffrey Epstein stuff, and lots of other things, you know, surrounding these kinds of issues. And so when you came on that show, I was very, struck by, you as a witness to this phenomenon, this matter, this, you know, very disturbing reality. And it was, you know, you have an intriguing story to tell, from your own perspective, from your own point of view. And it seems that it's something that you, have written about, you've written about before, but it seems like in The Vice of Kings, you really honed in on this whole issue. And in your case, it seems that although it's never entirely clear in from reading The Vice of Kings, it's never entirely clear what your personal stake in this whole matter is. It seems that there is some kind of personal stake that you do have in the matter, and so, you know, I want to talk, of course, a little bit later. I want to help to promote your newest work, 16. I'm sorry, what? 16 Maps of Hell, mm-hmm. Because that's also a fine work that's worth reading. But beginning with The Vice of Kings, first, can you tell me, forgive my Philistinism here, but the title, mm-hmm. I don't believe it's ever explained, I don't remember, it may be from something, but if it is, I don't know. Can you
explain what the title means? It's from the Book of the Law, the supposed received text that Crowley supposedly, allegedly transcribed, wrote, was dictated in 1904 in Egypt by Rose, his girlfriend at the time, who claimed to be channeling the god Horus. What he transcribed made this claim. Anyway. Mm-hmm. There's a line in the last book, the last part of that book, which is "Compassion is the vice of kings, stamped down the weak." I forget the exact words of the second part of that section, but that's the gist of it. That's the spirit of it. That for a king to have compassion would be a vice, and that.
Okay.
Just the duty of the strong to trample down the weak.
Right. Well, that makes sense. That sounds very cruelly. And now that I'm remembering it, it seems that maybe it was mentioned in the book itself someplace, but I just put that out of my mind.
It's quoted. Yeah. I don't dig into that particular quote, which has a number of different ways one could interpret it.
Right. Yeah. So, just sort of as an open-ended way of discussing this book, The Vice of Kings, which you published in 2019, and which is available, and I'll provide a link for it as well as a link to a link to 16 Maps of Hell and also to your blog. But just as a way of introduction, how would you explain what prompted you to compose this particular book?
Well, you were saying that it wasn't clear what my stake in it was, and I was thinking, well, that's true and not true. I think that the book makes it pretty clear that I was compelled to go on this investigation that became eventually the Vice of Kings, that began with the investigation into my own childhood, my past in Yorkshire, the section I'll call Yorkshire, and particularly tracing the development and the influence of the Fabian Society because of my paternal grandfather's involvement with that group, and with an eye to finding the areas of convergence between those agendas and what was came out about Jimmy Savile specifically in 2000 whenever it was, 12 or so. Mm-hmm. So what was I saying? So that what is in the book is that it becomes more and more clear to me in the second part of the book is where I focus on Aleister Crowley, which came later. And that was a separate investigation. What became part two of Vice of Kings began as a separate investigation. And I spliced the two together because, well, I wanted to turn this research into a book. And mm-hmm. they did seem that they would more or less fit together, but it wasn't particularly easy. And one of the ways that I tried to ground the part two of the book and make it compatible with part one, which was much more obviously autobiographical, even though it's more densely packed with research, I would say also, was to look at my own adulthood. In the first part, I looked at my childhood a little bit and just the ways that I saw the clues and the evidence of the Fabian agenda and the progressive push towards sexualization, you know, sexual liberation that included sexualization of children and so on and so forth. There were a lot of clues in my childhood that I didn't recognize as clues until I put them in this new context of the deep background of the Fabian Society and what, mm-hmm. you know, what Jimmy Savile was, you know, what was enabling Jimmy Savile's predations. So in part two, I look at my adulthood in terms of two things. One, the influence, the way that childhood that I don't fully remember shaped me, and two, the way that Aleister Crowley was an influence and how and why I took on Aleister Crowley as a role model, let's say, and occultism in general. So that I hope that would give more context to an exploration of Crowley and also make it fit more seamlessly with the first part. And what that also became about, really, or what the whole book was really about, was trying to map the contours of my own internal trauma without having any memory of any incidents around it, but having a growing body of evidence, perhaps pun intended. Don't know what just happened there. That was a weird blip. In my own body, as I recount in Vice of Kings, like things were coming up somatically, body sensations, dreams and nightmares and things. So certainly part two, but really the whole book really does constantly come back to what my stake is in this, which is that something happened to me as a child, or a series of things happened, or however we want to describe that.
Right.
And that I don't know what it is, but these, you know, this is the shape of it, more or less.
You have some conviction that you were abused, or that you were a victim of abuse at some time in some way, but you're not entirely sure when or how this happened.
Yeah. Or who?
But you do. Recount a situation where you had your family had a visitor, like an older guy who was staying with you and hanging around at your house. Maybe he was over for a party or something, and he was groping you under the table, and this was a source of amusement to your family.
The story became a source of amusement. I have no idea if the incident itself was. Mm-hmm. I don't have any memory of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any memory of that man either. I wouldn't even know about it if my brother, Sebastian Horsley, who's now dead, he died in 2010, if he hadn't included it as a jokey anecdote in his memoir, Dandy in the Underworld. So that's, yeah, what is that? I mean, that's mm-hmm. a piece of evidence that doesn't indicate abuse per se, although, of course, by today's super sensitive standards, or maybe oversensitive standards, being groped under the table would be abuse. And I'm not saying it isn't per se, but I don't mm-hmm. think it would be inherently traumatic, let's say.
Right.
It certainly could be disturbing, and certainly that if the family didn't take it seriously, that would be disturbing, and so on. But if it were an isolated incident, clearly I wouldn't want to make a mountain out of a molehill, and I don't think something like that would drive me the way I've been driven for most of my life, to try and get to the bottom of what's sometimes called the pedocracy, although I think that these terms aren't helpful. But anyway, mm-hmm. for shorthand, the child abusing elite. But clearly, I would say clearly that incident isn't an isolated incident, and is, if not a literal tip of the iceberg, as in that man himself was, you know, was more directly involved in my abuse. I don't know. I've got no evidence for that. I don't even know who he was. But a tip of the iceberg in the sense that that was the culture that I was growing up in. That was mm-hmm. the kind of people that I was surrounded by, and the kind of things that were happening. Now, if you juxtapose that with my own psyche, which I've been trying to exploring, particularly in the last few years, starting with Seen and Not Seen, there's a deep trauma there. There's a deep degree mm-hmm. of, well, let's say sexual dysfunction, although the listeners might interpret that in a way that I wouldn't particularly want them to. You know, I'm married, I've got a reasonably normal sex life, I think, for a married person, but I'm talking about subtler levels of sexual dysfunction. Also, sure. my interest in torture imagery as an adolescent, which I explore mostly in 60 Maps of Hell and Seen mm-hmm. and Not Seen, things that I've been aware of my whole adult life, that there was something a bit off about my sexuality, that's also evidence of trauma. And then these accumulating nightmares, and so on and so forth, and then the ways in which I've behaved. I mean, there are things that I don't even go into in Vice of Kings, not because they're so terrible, because actually the worst things I've ever done are in Vice of Kings, such as the almost killing a cat, mm-hmm. and some minor acts of violence against women that I was close to, as in slapping or grabbing, you know, just rage against women anyway, generally I've addressed mm-hmm. that. But in terms of what I've been able to track about my own sexuality and how compromised it's been, I don't include everything in there because people don't have enough understanding about these things.
Yeah.
Right. And this is to maybe veer on a more general thing, but you touched on it in the beginning that Sean Atwood and so many other researchers or podcasters or what have you tend to sensationalize this material. Well, I think that that's very central to the problem, is that this is something, what I'm trying to explore is something that's very intimate, very personal, very close to home for all of us. You said you've got no mm-hmm. personal stake in it, but that's not true. Everybody does. Everybody yeah. knows somebody who was a victim of this as a child, if not being that themselves and not,
right.
I mean, if it's true, I have to put that proviso, but you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I still have a difficult time believing it. This is the thing. And I've spent decades researching it.
And you make some, like, there's a ton of research in your book, The Vice of Kings, where you really connect the dots and you point out it's mostly, in relation to recent history in the UK. You make a lot of connections and show how, you know, lots of, you know, mainstream figures. And I mean, Jimmy Savile is one that's, of course, broken through, you know, into the mainstream, into mainstream knowledge. But, But you talk about a lot of people who, you know, have affiliations that were considerable with one party or other. I guess that the Fabian Society is mostly influential with the Labour Party, but of course the Conservative Party also had lots of seemingly unsavory people doing unsavory things, and mm-hmm. and so there's lots of research that you point out, and it seems that your central, or that a thesis in your work, is that this is an incredibly pervasive phenomenon, and that it isn't like what we used to think of child molestation being, you know, some weirdo hanging around outside of a schoolyard wearing a raincoat. I think you even use that as an example of how, you know, we used to think of this. But
yeah,
and of course I'm sure there are, you know, low, you know, there are cases of people who are not you know, high status, who are not powerful, who are not politically affiliated.
Sure, that's a good contrast. I mean, that is a good contrast. I know I make it, but you're making it in a slightly mm-hmm. different way. And it's a good contrast because, sure, there are, I mean, and this is part of the pathogen, let's say, that gets passed on through the culture and through abuse, that a person who was sexually abused as a child has their sexual development arrested and imprinted. And they mm-hmm. may be trapped or you know, locked in that period in time that they were sexually abused, and that does pertain to why they might only be able to get sexually aroused around children of the similar age to when they are abused, and that's a pedophile. That's somebody who doesn't really have any mm-hmm. control over their sexual responses. Now, if a person of that kind is just an ordinary working class guy, or even middle class, or even upper class that's unconnected, although that seems less likely, who does end up, mm-hmm. you know, the stereotypical guy in a brown raincoat, chances are,
right,
he's not going to act on it for a number of reasons, but the main one I want to bring up here is it's very hard to get away with it. If you don't have facilitating, and you don't have at the very least the social graces and the skill and the cunning and the sociopathic powers, let's say, to instill people with trust. That's number mm-hmm. one. And then number two is the connections to ensure that, you know, you can get away with it. And actually, a little different from the point I wanted to make, which is that the guy in the brown raincoat, which is, I imagine, closer to you or I at that level, not that we're ever, you know, with a guy right. in a brown raincoat, but I mean, if we were unfortunately imprinted with that and had those urges and we tried to act on them, that's the kind of guy we would end up as. He is aware that what he's doing is morally abhorrent, that he would be condemned, he would be vilified, he would be ostracized. There's an awful lot of pressure not to act on it. There's an awful lot of fear and shame and all the rest of it. So yeah. He may still be driven because the desire may be overpowering, but I just wanted to juxtapose that with what seems to be coming to light now, which is that if you move in circles where you are protected and you do have special privileges, and the abuse of children is being facilitated for you, none of that exists. It's not only that you're protected, you're also, the shame and the fear and the self-rejection and the loathing around it is being neutralized because you're moving in a different moral ambience in which
right.
actually those proclivities are being supported, encouraged, mm-hmm. validated, you know. There is an overlap with our culture, which I map in occult Yorkshire, but it's not so obvious to us now. And it's the during the 70s when homosexuality and other forms of sexual expression, if we could call them that, were being defended. Pedophilia also was at that time. Now, pedophilia, yeah. there was limited success around that, or it was a different policy was applied, I would say, because it was a much harder sexual proclivity to defend and justify for obvious reasons. But nonetheless, there has been a sociocultural attempt to normalize and protect and centralize sexual, I don't know what to call it now, because if I call it sexual deviance, of course I can be called a homophobe, right? But what do we call it? There's a spectrum, right? That's outside the bandwidth of, you see, already language is breaking down. But anyway, let's just say.
Deviance works for me, but.
Sorry?
I said deviance works for me, but I understand what you're saying.
I mean, words are dangerous, they're explosive, but a deviation from, it's not the nuclear family, but from the procreative sex act. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And it
should be added again, just a couple more things about the Vice of Kings before we move on to 16 Maps of Hell. You come from a rather powerful family, if I don't know if that is fair to say. Your father and your grandfather both ran a business that was pretty high profile and was involved in a lot of high profile things with high profile people.
That's fair to say. Yeah, I mean, it was an international food corporation, but also with a lot of political affiliations, because both my grandfather, particularly my grandfather, but also my father, were interested in labor politics. So they were very connected, and the business itself, Northern Foods, which later was taken over by Tony, I've forgotten his name now, Chris Haskins, my uncle, don't know why I said Tony, because of Tony Blair, he was the rural czar of Tony Blair later. So although while I was growing up, certainly, and generally my direct family didn't quite get to rub shoulders with prime ministers, they're pretty close. They rub shoulders with Bilderbergers and whatnot. None of this I was aware of at the time growing up. I mean, I was aware of it,
right?
I didn't, not consciously, I went to the parties and things, so I would have met some of these people, but I was just aware that they were rich people with liberal values.
And what here in America we would call the $64,000 question that occurs to me, that, you know, that I'm disturbed by, but also intrigued by, and you never quite get there in your book, because maybe it's not essentially the focus of it. But let me just ask you this question before we move on to 16 Maps of Hell. Mm-hmm. Why do you think? What makes the powerful into pedophiles? What is there? Is there an easy way to answer that question? Is there a way to understand this phenomenon, why people in circles of power gravitate towards, I mean, not everybody in power, I don't want to say it's all encompassing, but it seems much more, it seems to permeate things much more than one would like it to. And you pointed out that would seem to be, your point of view as well, because, you know, you pointed out to me, I said I didn't really have a stake in any of this, and I meant contrasted with you who felt that you might have been or probably were actually victimized as a child, which I'm almost totally sure that I wasn't. I have no memories in that regard, but
neither do but, I so.
Right. Yeah. But
even now, after all of this research and anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
But
I mean, most people do. We all have an innate resistance, even to the subject. So, right. I mean, you've said that, and I don't want to turn the tables on you, but I guess I am doing that a bit. But you said to begin with that the discovering this caused you PTSD.
Right.
So that does suggest that there was some deep resonance for you, because people, and if you, especially if you add to it the fact that you didn't turn away, because yes, people are appalled by this. That doesn't mean they're traumatized. Yeah. Very different. But they're appalled and disgusted, and then they turn away and they just don't want to address
it. Yes.
But the fact that you were horrified by it so deeply that you would refer to it as traumatic, and yet also you were compelled to keep looking. To me, that was in my own life, that was the first clue, that was the first question I started with, really, was why? Why am I so driven to look into this? And then of course I have to look at myself to answer that question, because none of the facts, none of the information, none of the data is going to answer the question of why I'm trying to find out this truth.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't want to, it's possible that it happened and I repressed it. That's certainly a possibility.
I think this is sort of to answer your question, the question you were trying to ask. It's a spectrum that is so wide that, you know, there's a danger that it would nullify the whole meaning of it. And a person who was skeptical or cynical could just say, well, if you're saying everybody's a victim of it, well, what, you know, why even talk about it at all? Or if you're going to conflate, like I was saying, that incident at the table, now I was saying that wouldn't be traumatic, but actually I want to redact that in a certain sense, because to make the point I want to make now, which is if we grow up in a culture that is absolutely soaked with this kind of pathology and this kind of exploitation and abuse, where adults will use children not just to gratify themselves, but inseparable from the gratification, to offload their own poisons, their toxins, their agony, their rage, their despair, all the stuff they can't deal with because they didn't process it in their own lives. They're using children to put all of that poison get rid of all the poison, to put it in the children. If we grow up in a culture where that's not just going on, but is being normalized, glamorized, glorified, turned into jokes, turned into entertainment, albeit maybe in subtle ways. We might have to get deep diving into subliminal imagery in Disney or whatever, but it's there. Beauty pageants for kids, that's a more obvious, easy target here. Then that in itself is having an influence, right? So, and then it's kind of inseparable from this. I think that as children, we're very open to the unconscious load of parents. And this is precisely what happens when a child is sexually exploited by an adult. They've got all this unconscious load that they're actually being driven by. And the child is open to this. They're not just physically vulnerable, they're psychically vulnerable as well. So actually one can be traumatized, I think, as a child, by very subtle things as well. Now, that is a wide spectrum, but I just mention it not to, I mean, I don't want to muddy the waters, but you know, trauma is anything that is overwhelming for us as children that we can't process. And if that is then around our sexuality, then we've got this load of affect in our bodies that we haven't been able to process and resolve. And so our sexuality becomes crippled. And that means our life force, is somehow compromised. And so we become victims of trauma. So I think it's I didn't start with looking at the extent of the trauma in my past. What I started with looking at really was the extent of my own dysfunctionality, how much I know that I'm wounded in this life. And then juxtapose that with the culture that we all grew up in, but some more than others. Admittedly, I am an extreme case. I'm not going to deny that in terms of what I grew up around. Not so sure about how damaged I am. That's kind of hard to gauge, but I don't meet many people who don't strike me as quite seriously damaged in today's world. And I do put these two things together. for sure. I mean, it seems as though there's going to be a connection, right, between a toxic and mm-hmm. abusive and exploitative culture and a whole bunch of damaged and dysfunctional people.
Why do you think the powerful gravitate especially to this particular pathology?
Well, I think that the power, and this is certainly what Vice of Kings and my other books really recently, but I think particularly Vice of Kings and 60 Amounts of Hell are trying to grapple with that the power and the pathology are in a certain sense inseparable. It's like the pathology of power and the power of pathology.
Mm-hmm.
So what I think is that, and to use another example of the spectrum of trauma in England, for years, including, you know, I was on the tail end of it, children, boys particularly, were sent away to boarding school where they might well be sexually abused and certainly be corporally punished. And that was all considered part of their preparation for life. That was part right. of their conditioning so that they would become successful, powerful, ambitious, driven people for the ruling class.
You call them savage, training them to be savage noblemen.
Yeah.
As opposed to noble savages, which was a nice turn of phrase, I thought.
That's right. Yeah, because otherwise the aristocracy would get flabby. And maybe the Marquis de Sade, maybe this is an aspect of the Marquis de Sade that I haven't read him. My brother was into him, that he either didn't acknowledge or he did and it hasn't been picked up by the culture at large. You know, the people who, they just think Marquis de Sade was a pervert. But there was a method to the madness, as far as I can see. There is a method to the madness, and so I would assume it would apply to de Sade as well. It wasn't simply about gratifying all of the most base urges. It was about honing one's capacity for savagery to compensate for eroding influence of luxury and power and wealth that can make a person flabby and soft. On the one hand, mm-hmm. one's constantly sharpening one's tooth and claws by victimizing weaker prey.
Mm-hmm.
There's a law of the jungle, and the vice of kings again stamp on the weak. And then the other thing is one is constantly affirming, strengthening, fortifying one's distinctness from the herd. The herd is the prey, and the aristocracy, the cryptocracy actually doesn't quite correlate with the aristocracy, certainly not anymore. The cryptocracy mm-hmm. Are the predators. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, to keep sharpening their tooth and claws as predators, but also keep reaffirming the distinction that it's us and them. We're the predators and you're the prey.
Mm-hmm.
So the ritualistic aspect of abusing children, it has a pragmatic, functional rationale behind it that's physical, social, and psychological, and probably spiritual too, but I don't really get into that, but energetic. There seems to be a way to harness power.
Yes.
To siphon power off from innocence, to steal innocence and turn it into power.
Yes, and I know that you're not a fan of David Icke, but or some of his stranger theories or ideas, but he does. I think he has done some interesting work in that regard, in so far as talking about how this sort of phenomenon appears to occur that
yeah.
you know, to it's kind of trendy to talk about today that adrenochrome is like this way, like who have been studying the pedocracy or pedogate or whatever you want to call it, it seems like that's the new thing, but who knows really how exactly it happens. But there is there does seem to be some way in which, as you say, energy is harvested by abusing, you know, those abusing the young, abusing the children, people, abusing those who are, you know, prepubescent, especially. And it's a, it's like, it's a disturbing thing to talk about, but there, it's like, I understand what you're saying, and I get the feeling that the, you know, these kinds of rituals, which, you know, it's all over Crowley's work, which I've not read Crowley. I've never, you know, I wasn't taken in or seduced by him the way that it appears that you were for a time in your life, mm-hmm. before you looked a little deeper, mm-hmm. at him. And a part of your work, it seems to be this, you know, making this case that we should take Crowley's metaphors more seriously, that you know, people just dismiss the way that he talks about I don't remember some of the specific things, but child sacrifice. Oh, that's just showmanship, that's just Crowley, you know, being outrageous. But you seem to be interested in saying, no, we should definitely take this seriously and maybe literally, you know. It makes for an interesting and a definitely compelling story.
Well, I mean, that's one of the necessary responses to the recognition of the prevalence of these kind of behaviors and methods and whatnot, is to start looking for it in our culture and looking for evidence of it. If it's really everywhere and at the highest levels, then you would expect it to find it at every level below as well, because mm-hmm. you know, shit runs downhill, what have you, whatever.
Yeah.
And they say scum rises the surface, but it goes both ways. And so yeah, why wouldn't you expect to find it?
Right.
Or why wouldn't you? I mean, all this, the whole thing happened around Pizzagate as well, so I'm not sure. I mean, on the one hand, the details are important to look at, but on the other hand, one can get lost in the details. So I'm not sure whether to speak of generalities or details here. But that was my approach with Crowley anyway. It's like revisiting him as well as a number of other people, influences, books, films, what have you, with a deeper understanding of the culture that they came out of and the influence that they've had, and finding out, well, how consistent they seem to be. Rather, so what seems like a separate reality and that creates cognitive dissonance for us, that, you know, how could this be going on behind the scenes? How could, as you put it, the people that we thought were protecting us are actually exploiting us, and so on. There's a constant cognitive dissonance because we just keep going back and forth from, it's like the They Live sunglasses. You take them off, you put them on, you take them off, but you know, you can't reconcile the two somehow because they're so different. The trick is to learn to see without the glasses, or without imagining reptilians, you know, going all the way mm-hmm. into Eichland, by looking for the subtleties, the subtle mm-hmm. clues that are in everything, and they're going to be in the things that we love and hold sacred too, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but I mean, naturally they're going to be the places that we least want to find them, not that they're most likely to be there, but that's a place to look, because those are the things that have influenced us. Now, Crowley, in a sense,
The church.
Well, yes, that's already been exposed, hasn't it? This is an irony that Nathaniel Harris also has pointed out, that currently there's a mindset which is Satanism is the only religion where the participants, the practitioners, don't abuse their children.
Right.
Because now Satanism is being protected as, how could you vilify? Whereas the church is fair game. And it's a bit like that with Crowley. to some extent.
Yeah.
And of course, part of that is, like Jimmy Savile, you put it front and center, and people think, well, I couldn't possibly be doing those kind of things, because if he did, he'd have the guise of piety, because we've come to associate the craven and the perverted with piousness. It's so weirdly messed up, right?
It's in the great inversion, you could call it.
Yeah.
So this is all fascinating discussion. I want to wrap up by transitioning into talking about your current book, 16 Maps of Hell. This book was, which you kindly let me read the manuscript of. This was inspired by your cinephilism, right? Your kind of obsession with film. And that's another interesting parallel, because like you, I am a kind of a lifelong cinephile myself. I loved movies as a kid, just like you did, just like you give an account of in 16 Maps of Hell, and also in some other places. We had different obsessions. You know, you were really into Clint Eastwood and Dirty Harry movies, and I don't know, you're like maybe 4 years older than me, so I don't know if that's the fact that those movies were out, the Dirty Harry movies were out when you were sort of in that age of processing. And for me, it was Star Wars and Indiana Jones and, you know, other kind of the late 70s and early 80s science fiction and fantasy movies that really grabbed me. And then later I started getting into like the auteurs, and Scorsese, and the others. And, you know, thought for a time when I was college age, I had this, you know, I briefly had this inkling of, you know, going to film school to become the next Scorsese or the next Jim Jarmusch, or, you know, I was more, you know, my taste had become a bit more artistic and by that time, a bit more, you know, artsy than like the kind of popcorn movies that I'd been into when I was a kid. But still, it was all cinema. It was all, you know, just this love of movies. And for you, you actually went to Hollywood, and you actually cultivated some connections, and you had some connections because of your family. So you knew some people, kind of knew some people, and you made connections elsewhere, and you wrote a few screenplays, and you had a few times when it seems like you almost made it, but just missed making it in Hollywood. And what's fascinating to me about your book, 16 Maps of Hell, is this is about you making an effort, it seems, to purge yourself of your cinephilism, this lifelong obsession of yours, which maybe was driven by the trauma in your life. I get the impression that, you know, you make that connection. You look to movies and also to comic books and other, you know, elements of popular culture. You look to these things as a means of escape, and a way of, you know, you saw yourself, you'd like to see yourself as, you know, a character like Dirty Harry, who wasn't gonna put up with this bullshit, you know, who was just gonna, you know, blow the bad guys away and be tough and strong and that sort of thing. And you know, I related to Luke Skywalker, similar kind of thing. As a
really,
as a
Luke,
kid,
not Han Solo. We definitely had a different sensibility then.
I guess I was unusual in that regard, but I always sort of Luke was my boy, I just saw myself in him, and part his vulnerability was something I, even as a kid, I kind of gravitated towards, and I understood the appeal of Hans, the wisecracking, cynical type of guy, but I didn't really see myself in him. Here's the question maybe we could finish up on, because this is a question that your book made me examine. A lot of people point out to me, and they're right, about how Hollywood is just filled with filth from top to bottom. It's just a gross, ugly, disgusting business, full of awful people who do terrible things, including things with children, as we've seen, we've seen numerous allegations, from Corey Feldman but numerous, he was the most high profile person for a while, but there have been plenty of others. Elijah Wood talked about it. There's so many other seemingly clear-cut cases of it. And then my response, so people say, just stop watching movies, Nowicki, it's a filthy business. You'd stop mm-hmm. giving Hollywood your money. And my response is that, the business is awful, but film is a form, it's an artistic expression that can be separated from the filthiness of the business. Now, it seems to me like in your book, 16 Maps of Hell, you are maybe saying something different. You're maybe saying that there's something about film that is inherently corrupting. Am I correct in saying that, or?
It's the tools and how they're used, isn't it? I'd say it's inherently dissociating. Like the appeal of movies mm-hmm. is separate from the function that they provide or the service they provide, which is to escape into a fantasy, which is dissociation, to dissociate from physical reality and mm-hmm. exist for a brief period in this forgetting chamber that Quentin Crisp called it of manufactured fantasy. So mm-hmm. But dissociation is a necessary aid to survival. And right. daydreaming is part of existence, and dreaming, there's no harm in dreaming per se. Mm-hmm. We do it, it's a natural function. So I think what I'm looking at more is how it's been used, and both the films that we see and the TV shows that we watch and love, and the way that we respond to them, or the way that we use them, or need them, or get addicted to them, is symptomatic of trauma. So there's something. The drugs an analogy here. It's an easy analogy. I mean, coca and coca leaves, what have you. Once it's refined and becomes cocaine, pretty hard to argue for that being benign. But as an actual plant, part of nature, has its place in the natural and the ecosphere, maybe even has its uses as a medicine, almost certainly mm-hmm. does have its uses. Sugar is another example. Certainly sugar's in fruit and all these other things, and sugar cane is good for the teeth. Once it gets refined, industrialized, and put in just about everything on the supermarket shelf, then you've got an over-sugared mm-hmm. bio-organism of humanity, and it's a problem. So yeah, the problem with Hollywood, it's not, well, it is Hollywood, but it's not Hollywood so much as the superculture. So the superculture is what I'm trying to map with these books. And then Hollywood is just my latest and I hope last, you know, specimen to come under the scalpel. And then movies themselves come out of Hollywood. So you've got Hollywood comes out of the superculture, and movies come out of Hollywood. So of course, you know, any fruit, if a tree is diseased, then any fruit is going to be carrying some of that disease. But it doesn't necessarily mean they shouldn't eat the fruit, because the fruit is still a fruit, and it's still got nutrients. It's just that it's also carrying some of these toxins, or maybe, you know, maybe pesticide would be a better analogy, I don't know. But, you know, I still eat apples from the supermarket, even though I know that they've been, you know, there's toxins and whatnot. But I figure, you know, it's still worth it for the nutrients. I can't quite make the same argument for Hollywood or movies and TV shows, because you know, I'm it's more of an addiction, right? It's not that, oh, I should watch a movie because I think it's good for me, although I sometimes try that. But just fuck, it's been another hard day. Thank God I get to relax in front of a good TV show. I really appreciate it. Right. I'm really grateful for that time, even though I'm aware that, in my perspective and interpretation, you can't separate the product from the system that's produced it and the individuals who've informed it. So, so what do you do there? Well, the thing, and this can be a rationalization, but the thing to keep in mind in terms of what your friends are saying, well, just stop watching it, it's so toxic, is that everything is tainted in our world. So unless you're ready to actually go Luddite and completely disconnect, then you might just end up turning yourself into a pretzel, I might, trying to you know, walk between the rain, the acid raindrops of this culture. Yeah. That some of it's going to hit me. And just to finish the answer, the point I make in 16 Maps of Hell, in order to try and reconcile my own cognitive dissonance, is that in order for Hollywood to function as the engine of propaganda and of manipulation and sorcery, as I finally diagnose it or describe it at the end, in order for it to function, it has to produce good product as well as the crap. And it's not just that, I mean, Triumph of the Will was supposedly a masterpiece, but it was a Nazi propaganda piece. Not just that propaganda has to be well designed, as in the case of Mindhunter or something like that, in order for us to imbibe it. That's obvious. But I mean, even that the industry has to allow for, or will allow for, if it's cunning enough, for pure works of art to come through it as a way to give it, you know, valence, credence, validity, meaning, prestige.
Yeah.
Of course. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, it's pretty hard for me to discern or think that I can discern, but I certainly know that some of the stuff that I watch, that's why I watch it, hopefully most of the stuff I watch, it is quite creative, clever, you know, well written. There's beauty in there, there's talent. The problem is that I know two things. One, I know it's supporting the system, that it's part of the, it's what keeps the machine oiled, is to create work that has value. And the other thing is that I'm hooked, and I kind of wish I wasn't. That I think the act of escaping reality into manufactured fantasies in itself perpetuates a disorder in my own psyche. That's what I think. I think I keep topping up with manufactured imagery, and so my dream life is constantly being recolonized. I'm concerned about that possibility. Anyway, I think it's inevitable. Actually, I write that in 60 Maps, but that's going to happen. The more we watch movies, and the more as we continue to watch movies and TV shows, we just keep, you know, I just said it really, just stop putting more content into our unconscious that came from this industry. So it's like eating, not necessarily junk food, but food, comfort food. So like if I eat macaroni cheese all mm-hmm. the time, it's not necessarily going to harm me per se, but it's going to deplete my energy, and I'm going to have to do a lot more work digesting and detoxifying and eat more radishes or whatever. That's my sense. So, you know, mm-hmm. I would like to spend more time in nature mm-hmm. and doesn't mean I have to stop watching the stuff, but I have to be aware that it needs to be flushed out. Most of it. There's probably some nutrients in there.
Now, I mean, like, do you think that film is a more dissociative form than, say, literature or, I don't know, music? Like, yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, because it's all immersive. Well, it's not quite yet, is it? But mm-hmm. I mean, they're getting there. But it, all the senses are engaged. It simulates reality mm-hmm. in a way that none of the other forms do. Nobody could mistake reading even Crime and Punishment for actually being there in Russia in the 1800s, you know, in a dirty apartment with a sociopathic genius or what have you. It's not mm-hmm. too far removed, whereas a movie it's actually very close. Like the thing was the mirror neurons. We see physical beings, human beings moving around and doing things mm-hmm. very similar to the brain from seeing actually that happening on the street. Not the same as being there, because we're not smelling it and interacting it. But it's not that different from in a car, looking through your car with a windshield, watching a scene on the street, say. Pretty similar to that, and that's real.
And it can have a very powerful effect. I found this kind of amusing. You only made like a footnoted, you referred in a footnote to last year's movie Joker, and that was the only reference to Joker in your book. The people who watch my channel know I fucking love that movie so much. You know, I watched it I don't know how many times, and it really it was, you know, what you want to talk about, immersive. That was, you know, I saw myself in it. I felt myself in it. It was so well made. It was so intense. It was a cinematic experience that I hadn't had for a long, long time. It's kind of a reminder, they say, and I don't know whether this, the official story about John Hinckley is true or whether, you know, he was an MK Ultra victim.
The official story definitely isn't true. It's
the official story that he kept watching Taxi Driver, and that was what made him want to kill Reagan to save Jodie Foster. Yeah. Even if that's just folklore, it's compelling folklore because, you know, movies like Taxi Driver and Joker can be incredibly immersive and can be very cathartic if you feel yourself to be in a certain place in your life.
Maybe, although catharsis, I think we don't understand what catharsis is in the truth, the original sense of the Greek theaters. That really is a purging. I very much doubt that a movie, at least 99 times out of 100, is purging. Mm. For me, Taxi Driver was a way to better understand my own propensity for violence and destruction and alienation and loneliness. Mm-hmm. I think it was valid mm-hmm. in that sense, but I wouldn't say cathartic. I'm not sure that any movie I've seen is cathartic, because I think that the tensions that they build up are artificial tensions, and then you have a release of those, but they're not the tensions that you brought to the movie. That would be a real catharsis. Mm.
And you're also, you know, just before we wrap up here, because we have been talking for a while and it's been a fascinating discussion, but your work also really made me question how often are the major movies that get out there that we end up seeing, you know, in the movie theaters or streaming or whatever, however they're being, you know, presented to us, you know, and there's a push behind them, and you know, they're being discussed in places, and they're being highly advertised and promoted. You know, how many of them are not psyops of some kind? You know, I think your work really really raised that question for me. I think there was a time when I would have said, "Oh well, no, this isn't a psyop of any kind. This is just escapism. It's just really well made." But when you see how things are, how the power structure is interconnected, and how Hollywood and you know, in Washington and other power centers, you know, how there's so much connectivity between them. Even like an example I used, even a show like The X-Files, which was supposed to, you know, the hero of that show, Mulder, the David Duchovny character, was supposed to be this sort of misfit who you know, who was really down on the FBI, who questioned them and thought they were closed-minded and so forth. And so you would think this was kind of a subversive take on the FBI, but the FBI must have been behind the production of X-Files, because, you know, anytime, as I understand it, anytime any alphabet organization like the FBI or the CIA or others is, you know, mentioned, and like you see them, people wearing their gear and they're being presented, they have to sign off on it, I believe, or like the military, like these Michael Bay films, you know, that show the U.S. Army kicking ass somewhere or other, and they're, you know, it's referred to officially as the U.S. Army. So those are cruder examples, but you know, to what degree do you think that's true? I mean, how, and like, are can psyops be subtle too? Because I honestly can't think of, like, when I think of Joker, I was very protected. I still really love it. I still think it's a great movie, but somebody was just pointing out to me the other day, look at what happened just months after the release of Joker, which ended with, you know, Gotham City in chaos and there being riots everywhere and people looting and burning things down. Mm-hmm. And then 2020 happens. It's weird. Like, I don't know whether there's a causal connection, but I mean, what would you say in response to that?
So a psyop is a psychological operation, and any movie is a psychological operation insofar as it's trying to influence the audience into certain perceptions and responses. And let's face it, behaviors. The behavior part might not be conscious and deliberate and intentional, but essentially it's there one way or another. Like, if we're moved and inspired by a movie, it's going to influence our thinking and our behavior afterwards to some degree. Mm-hmm. And that's central to what a psychological operation is. So what you're really asking about is, you know, how much intentionality is there, and I would say maybe even how much malevolence is yeah, closer to the point, because right, a person can make a movie that's intentionally meant as a psychological operation, in the sense that they want it to bring about change in the world and through influencing the audience. But they have their heart in the right place. I was going to say their heart in the right place, because you can't say yeah, good intentions, because the worst right, men have good intentions. Mm-hmm. But I don't think a movie that really wants to inspire people is inherently you know, wrong-headed or something.
Right.
And inspiring right, is also a kind of, that's an influence, isn't it? So I know mm-hmm, I'm sort of hedging the answer here, but I think that the best answer is maybe not a very satisfactory one, but that maybe it's the wrong question, because the only way to really answer it would be to look at every movie case by case. Now, your case is the Joker. So if I were you personally, what I would have ended up doing, like I did with Leonard Cohen in the book, was putting that movie under the microscope to find out, to look for the evidence. I would say, yeah, that does stand out as a recent movie that has the earmarks of a psyop in the conspiratainment use of that term, like with Dark Knight Rises and so on, you know, all that stuff around those movies and Sandy Hook and James Holmes and all the rest of it. Plus the content of the movie itself does seem somewhat suspect, I would say. Not that it wasn't a good movie, I don't mean that, but the actual, the sort of triggers and the themes and whatnot. But so that's what I do. And that's what I do in the book with The Exorcist, particularly, and a number of other case, well, it's all case studies, isn't it? But in terms of specific movies, I don't analyze very many movies, but The Exorcist is one. And the reason I chose that was both the movie itself and the background players, Blatty and Friedkin particularly, have all the earmarks of psychological operatives, like it's all operations, like it's really, I would say it's conclusive that The Exorcist is an example of a conscious, deliberate and malevolent form of a psyop. However, that's, as I say, one could find 1,000 cases that wouldn't prove that the 1,001st case was a psyop. One would still have to just keep checking each product as an individual case, otherwise one ends up, you know, chunking everything up into a paranoid worldview that isn't rooted in experience and research and deduction. But the other part of my answer is that something can be a psyop in the sense that it's destructive or harmful without malevolent intent and without the best intentions in the world. And that's a much subtler thing. And I think there's a continuum here. And I want to bring it back to David Icke, because I wanted to anyway before. So I want to say what my problem with David Icke is that, because there are, you know, some people have speculated that he's a shill, he's an operative. And many people have asked the very valid question, if he's for real, and if what he's saying is true, then how come he gets to fill Wembley Stadium? There's definitely a incongruity there. The guy is very successful. He says he's being blocked left, right, and center, but he's still best-selling books and has millions of followers or hundreds of thousands. So, but that I didn't want to go there because that's just an example of good reasons to be skeptical. But my problem is Icke is independent of whether he's been compromised wittingly or not. I personally think he's sincere. And I also think that much of what he says is probably true and accurate. And I think he's, in many ways, kind of a good guy. And I actually like him and I like things he says. But I just find that overall, the way that David Icke provides information is counterproductive. And the reason is, and I've talked about it before, is that the context is insufficient. He's talking about the very darkest, most horrifying aspects of our social reality and even metaphysically. And the context is, it's not that it's exactly sensationalized, but it's superficial. It's this thing of the medium is the message. And it's what you were saying at the beginning, that why I stood out like a sore thumb on Sean Atwood is I'm not just here to spew out all kinds of theories and facts and interpretations and descriptions of reality that are going to shock, horror and titillate you. I'm not going to shock and awe you. Because I've learned in my own life that actually wasn't helpful. There's a part of me that actually gets off on seeing how fucked up and bad and dark and horrible things are. And I'm not crying inside. I'm not feeling the awful grief of this reality that's under the skin and in the bones and is very, very personal. And so I think, for David Icke to talk about those things and for people to be consuming them in a way that they can just then go back to their cheeseburger and their Netflix, something is wrong here. Not that they should start a revolution or something, but it's not—it's not sufficiently disturbing, or it's disturbing only at the intellectual level. And so my sense about that is that, and I've talked about it in a slightly different way, that it has to do with knowledge that is being given isn't earned, and so we haven't. It's a bit like if somebody gives you bulbs to plant, but they don't tell you anything about how to till the earth and anything about how to grow them. You just chuck them in your backyard and then you wonder why they died. Well, it's not enough just to give someone information. They need the context in which they can make sense of it. And we have to create that context ourselves. So the research, like for me, David, what I try to do is I try to include myself and how I've come on this knowledge and this information and how I'm trying to apply it and what it means to me. Always the context is my own personal life, and maybe I'm wrong and maybe I'm deluded. And rather than being a disseminator of information that people can gather around as if I was Jesus, that's what David Icke thought he was, right, to begin with. He was the second coming. Now he gets to kind of play that role, even though he doesn't talk like that anymore. He's become this fount of dark information about our world. And it weaponizes the truth, is my opinion. That's the way I'd soundbite it, by divorcing it from context and by being handed over without any of the tools or the deeper, the deeper sympathy or connection that would actually help us to use it, to work with it, to make sense of it. That's probably why your friends say, well, if you think Hollywood's bad, just stop watching Hollywood movies, because they don't see that there's a context for this material, which isn't just about condemning and seeing how horrible the world is, but about purging something from ourselves. About recognizing something and understanding ourselves. That's a very deep psychological process, and I don't hear much psychology from David Icke, and I don't see it much psychology in something like the X-Files, say, to connect it to your question. The X-Files wouldn't have to be a conscious, deliberate disinformation program, although it looks a hell of a lot like that. It could be well intended, and so on and so forth. Why are the CIA cooperating? Because they know nobody's going to take this information and run with it in a way that's going to jeopardize the future plans. First of all, it's old classified stuff. And second of all, it's turned into entertainment. So it just discredits it for most people because, it's just like the X-Files. And third of all, it takes it out of the context, which is the horror of organized child trafficking, for example. Something that's viscerally so repellent that we don't even know how to think about it. So I think a lot of the movies that we like, it's not that they're consciously or deliberately disinforming us, but that there's an awareness, a high level awareness, whether it's the people making the movies don't need to know. They can think they're just doing their work and being creative, that truth can be very destructive, right? So if people aren't ready for it, and it's delivered to them in a way that isn't empathic, isn't sensitive and tender and loving, like a parent that just hits its child on the head and tells it that masturbating is a sin. Well, that isn't truth, is it? But masturbating is bad for you. I think that probably is true. Well, maybe the sin part is true. But anyway, you get the example, right? That's not going to help. No. The child's just going to grow up deranged and shamed. And so the truth has been delivered in a way that actually is destructive.
Yeah. So I guess the last question I'll leave with is another big, big question that maybe isn't answerable, but, I guess, I wonder kind of with all of these evils afoot, how do we go forward? I mean, there was all this stuff with you know, with Q and QAnon, I don't want to make fun of Q, the QAnon stuff too much, because I think most of the people who follow it are good-hearted people. So it kind of sticks in my craw when it gets mocked too much, but I do think it's probably not the way. It's probably disinfo. So since Q isn't happening, you know, since there isn't going to be this takedown from above with the white hats, a lot of people thought was going to happen, how do we go forward, you know, fighting this terrible evil? Like I feel like I have to do something. I have to do my part, but and I guess we all have our parts, different parts that we can play in this, but is there a way to go forward? You know, what would be your recommendation how do we, you know, those of us who are conscious and aware that this is going on, how do we proceed in this world? Like, how do we fight it effectively?
Well, those are two questions, or more than two, but certainly right at the end, you went from how do we proceed to how do we fight it?
Yeah.
And so the assumption presumably is that in order to proceed, we have to fight it. So that creates an image of a sort of thicket of brambles or something. If we want to get through it, we're going to have to hack our way through it. That may be an error, like it may be, but we're trying to push through something rather than just keep looking, because we're overwhelmed by these brambles and these thorns, and we just think, fuck it, I'll just start hacking away. That could be a very bad strategy, particularly if you haven't really looked around 360 degrees, determine which way you want to go and whether there's a way that isn't overrun by brambles and thickets, that where evil isn't the predominant force. Evil, as far as we know, there's no reason to think that evil is the predominant force in the universe. Therefore, unless, of course, I'm sure there are certain philosophies that, anyway, but I'm not. I don't see any evidence for that. Let me put it that way. Nature itself is violent, it's true, and ruthless, but I don't see any evidence for evil in nature either. Not really. There are some aberrational things in there. They're pretty horrific. But malevolence, I don't really see. So then that means malevolence only seems to exist at the social level. And so then the question is, I mean, I know Christians would quite argue with me here, but there's metaphysical evil and all that. But I find that to be, that's a thorny question in itself. And anyway, if we want to be Christian about this, and we might, some listeners might, and I do think there's a lot of value in it, then resist not evil is the least quoted saying in the gospel. It literally is, because I Googled it recently in the images, and my Twitter account came up because I tweeted resist not evil. And I only have 1,500 followers. So that's how little the term resist not evil appears on the internet. It's incredible. It's just not understood, that phrase, and it's, or that principle, I should say. And therefore it's not replicated. So fighting is a bad idea, in my opinion. We're already locked in some internal struggle anyway. And the alternative is something I just read recently, which was actually about Wittgenstein, the philosopher, but I don't read philosophy, but it was to do with the his approach in philosophy was not to try and change anything but the way that he saw the world, but that by changing the way that we see the world, we change everything. So that means the onus is on us. It's a change in perception. And I think that can only happen by looking. Like, we have to keep looking. And I think this is where evil comes in as a focus. And there's a need to acknowledge the apparent reality of evil. say apparent, that maybe because nothing else compels us to look away on the one hand, and on the other hand makes us want to change our perception. And I think the trap of evil, apparent evil, is that it hooks us into its design and makes us try to change it, to change the world, and, mm-hmm. and to fight the evil in the world so that we can move through the world. Not necessary. We can move through the world. We know this, even with everything going on. Probably your life, like my life, is pretty good, actually. Mm-hmm. It's the knowledge of this stuff that's the burden. And mm-hmm. there's something in that. Knowledge can be a burden. But the opportunity, I think, in my experience and my work, is kind of meant to help show that just by not turning away from the knowledge of good and evil, but not trying to use it, not trying to wield it, but just not turning away from it, something changes in us, and our perception gradually changes.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll keep looking, and you see, well, okay, there are brambles, but there's also blackberries, and then there's mm-hmm. also a tree, and then there's also roses, and then there's also a forest, and there's also a sky, and there's also a sun, and there's also a meadow. It's not just brambles. And then right. you know, the more we see, the more, oh, okay, so the brambles are just part of everything, and I don't have to actually, you know, drive through them and mm-hmm. tear the flesh from my bones just to prove that, well, I don't know what, really, that I'm mm-hmm. not, I'm not like that, you know. I'm not.
Yeah.
You might want the blackberries. There's mm-hmm. another thing, but then so then you've got to approach with great caution, so that you don't get pricked. Mm-hmm. But if you and you might want to cut back the thorns so that you can get the blackberries more. I quite like this analogy because I really rose and thorns is the other one. I don't think mm-hmm. you only find evil where there's good, because it's mm-hmm. it's a contrast. And it wouldn't really be evil. I mean, there would be no evil if it wasn't good, but it wouldn't even be evil if it wasn't affecting the good in some way, which brings mm-hmm. us to our core subject, isn't it? Which is the abuse of children and of innocence.
Right. Yeah. So I think another way of putting what you're saying is to cultivate habits of mind that don't ignore evil, but that don't fixate on it and don't... I don't know. Don't lead one to despair. Mm-hmm. Cultivate habits of mind that are healthy and that are that get you out of the mire in some way, instead of sinking you deeper into it.
Perhaps. Well, I mean, this is, of course, it's metaphor, so. I mean, yes, I don't disagree, but because you're talking in imagery, I'm
right.
I'm inclined to use a different metaphor to kind of knock your metaphor out of the way with my metaphor, which I just talked about this today. That the lake, the scum is on the surface of the lake, and the toxins and all that, whatever it is, yeah. it could be. Pollutants from the industrial waste factory. It's pretty nasty stuff, and it looks like it's everywhere, but actually the depths of the lake, that the majority of our experience in any given moment is down in the depths. So maybe we yeah. have to go through it and not mm-hmm. not be put off and not think we've got to fight our way through it, because the scum on the surface of the lake, it's repellent, but it's not actually, it can't actually stop us from breaking through and into the deep.
Yeah.
And so the deep of nature and of existence, I would say, is unpolluted.
Mm-hmm.
It's the surface that is so contaminated and so distorted. Mm-hmm. So yeah, to be able to look at it, not look away and not get consumed by despair, by identifying with it and thinking, oh my God, we're fucked.
Yeah.
That's very hard. Yeah. Very, very hard. I don't want to, you know, underestimate. I'm not saying I'm capable of it. I've got so far, but I've only seen a small fraction of how bad things are. I'm convinced of that. Things are really, really bad for humanity right now. I don't personally think we're going to make it. Well, I should rephrase that. I don't think, I don't know how to rephrase it. I don't think that the way of life that we have currently and the configuration that we have is going to last much longer. I think there may be a few humans that make it, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was only Adam and Eve, you know.
I hope it's not the Great Reset that they're talking about now. I hope that's not on the horizon. I hope that's not the thing that you're referring to, because...
No, well, I don't know. I'm referring to an organism that is so far gone that it doesn't seem likely to survive, so it maybe just needs to salvage just a cell or two so that it can regenerate itself over a period of time and grow itself a new organism. I know that metaphor doesn't fit with human beings, does it? But there are certain kinds of organisms that can be almost totally destroyed and just a few cells can then replenish. I'm certainly not suggesting this as a policy. No, that I don't know what the Great Reset has in mind. But as an antidote to despair, which is that we don't have to be selfish about this. If one man and woman survive and then the earth is still healthy and able to, you know, produce apple and orange trees, that's okay, isn't it? It's not an unhappy ending. It's better than the alternative, which, as I see it, is all of us escaping into an artificial intelligence realm while our bodies are being harvested by, don't even get me started on that one. That's
like the Matrix sort of, the Matrix psyop, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, I think there's some really dark possibilities that are opening up for us now, and that to many people, they look like the solution. And so then I tend to flip that over and say, and I'm aware this is dangerous because someone like Extinction Rebellion, you know, might be talking about these kind of things, but maybe the problem, what we think is the problem, that there's a solution in there too. For me personally, it's be willing to just cut everything back to the basics. And you know, if we had to survive hunting and gathering again, that would be really fucking hard, but it wouldn't necessarily be a bad or a tragic ending, would it?
No,
we might actually be happy that way if we could make it through the period of cutting down on our addictions. We might be happier living off the land, and simple hand to mouth day to day living. Yeah. So I think there's hope for that. I really do. I think as human beings, we've got a storehouse of ancient wisdom, and we know how to be in harmony with nature. But the challenge is, are we willing to follow the breadcrumbs out of the labyrinth and leave the great AI technocracy matrix behind forever? Or would we rather, you know, reign in hell? In our little petty domains, and so it's for every individual question. You know, I'm not entirely confident that I'll have the courage.
Yeah,
but I'm pretty sure some people will. Some of us will.
Well, it's sobering, but I guess we'll, you know, maybe these next couple of decades, we'll see what choices face us. And our children, those of us who have children.
You have children?
I do. I have two children. So I've got...
It's very different. Yeah, I don't have children. That changes a lot in terms of what I'm talking about today. So
I have to, maybe that's part of, that's certainly part of what affects my perspective on things. Now, do you rule out children, or is it something that you just think it's you're past the
for
opportunity?
Me, yeah, I'm over the hill now, pretty much. I would love to have had children. Could see adopting. I certainly don't think bringing children into this world is a bad idea, except so far as most parents aren't mature enough to do it. In that sense, yeah. I think it's a bad idea, but not in the sense that the world's so fucked up. I think that children will lead us through this.
Yeah. Yes, they must possess part of the answer, which is part of why they're being exploited.
Yes.
The innocence is part of what is essential to our salvation. Yeah. I would say so.
Spontaneity and innocence is grace. It's like grace.
Yeah. Well, this has been a very, very interesting discussion, and I'd love to talk again sometime. But let me just end our discussion now by reminding people that you have a new book out called 16 Maps of Hell, and this is not a book you can find on Amazon, right? That's you decided right.
I actually got a copy there. So, what, 600 pages, roughly. I self-published, so I'm just packaging and sending them out personally. It's available as Kindle on Amazon. And I've got another 100 copies or so, I think. Well, I've got 70 currently, but I'm waiting for the hardback. If people are interested, then they can order that at my website, horticulture.com. There's also the weekly podcast called The Liminalist.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I will be sure to plug all of your stuff that we've talked about tonight. But anything else you want to say before we sign off, before we wrap up this wide-ranging conversation that we've had about good and evil
I don't think so. I certainly have got into a lot. I think just the main impetus behind what I do, as far as I can see, so I have some unconscious drives, is to connect to people, to connect to the people that it's fruitful to connect to. So that's, I'm always open to connecting. You know, if people would like to write to me directly, they can write. You can send an email at jason@protonmail.com. I do weekly meetings on Zoom and participating in various group projects and activities, including a men's group. And that seems to be where the fruit is that we're cultivating here, is the fruit of human connection.
Mm, that's great. All right. Well, again, great to talk to you finally. I will post this on my, I'm still on YouTube Exile on my main page, but I will, until next Sunday, but I will post this on my temporary page for now. And then when I get access to my main page, I will post it there as well. But if you'd like to post this video on your page too, please feel free to.
Okay. Well, I'll have to send it to you first, but yes, good luck getting back on YouTube unbanned, and I'll send this in the next day or so.
Okay, great. Well, it's good to talk to you, Jason, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Likewise, Andy.
All right. Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye.